A scenario is just a story about the future, one possible future, usually driven by one or two forces really taking a hand. So it might be, you know, what does the future of education look like if, let's just say, extended reality goes mainstream? Or what happens if healthcare becomes a leading sector of American society and economics? So I publish these scenarios in different ways. I workshop them with different audiences. And these are all ways of connecting with people to try to give them better intelligence about where the future of education is headed.
The Digital to Learn podcast is dedicated to exploring both what's new and what's good in the use of technology in teaching and learning.
Our mission is to have the best minds sitting in front of our microphones, sharing evidence-based strategies for digital teaching and learning.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
Thank you for joining us. And now, the Digital to Learn podcast.
Welcome to the Digital to Learn podcast. I'm here with my co-host, Brad Garner. Hi, Brad.
Hi, Tiffany.
And we are welcoming to the show today, Brian Alexander.
Brian Alexander is an internationally known futurist, researcher, writer, speaker, consultant, and teacher, working in the field of how technology transforms education. He completed his English language and literature PhD at the University of Michigan in 1997. Brian has pioneered multi-campus interdisciplinary classes and served colleges, universities, and nonprofits as a consultant on higher education and digital technologies. In 2013, Brian launched a business, Brian Alexander Consulting, LLC. Through BAC, he consults throughout higher education in the United States and abroad. Brian speaks widely and publishes frequently, with articles appearing in venues including The Atlantic Monthly, Inside Higher Ed. He has been interviewed by and featured in The Washington Post, MSNBC, The Wall Street Journal, U.S. News and World Report, National Public Radio, The Chronicle of Higher Education, The Atlantic Monthly, Reuters, the National Association of College and University Business Officers, Pew Research, Campus Technology, The Hustle, and the Connected Learning Alliance. He recently published Academia Next, The Futures of Higher Education for Johns Hopkins University Press, and started work on Universities on Fire, Higher Education in the Age of Climate Crisis. His two other recent books are Gearing Up for Learning Beyond K-12 and The New Digital Storytelling. Brian is currently a senior scholar at Georgetown University and teaches graduate seminars in their learning, design, and technology program. We're so excited to have Brian Alexander on the Digital to Learn podcast. Welcome, Brian.
Thank you so much. Hello.
So, Brian, one of the first things we'd like to do is to just to get to know our guests a little bit and give our audience a chance to know who Brian Alexander is. So we're going to ask you some totally ridiculous questions. The first one is, your favorite musical genre?
Right now, probably death metal.
Yeah. Wow. That's a first for us.
Excellent. Yeah. Examples would be what?
Oh, there's a wide range of bands, everything from, you know, like Burzum, a whole bunch of Norwegian and Scandinavian metal bands. They often have ridiculous names, and their vocal style. I mean, so the you know, you recognize instrumentation from metal is just usually sometimes very fast, sometimes very slow, but then the voices are different. Instead of instead of melodic, they're more like this.
Are you a musician by any chance?
Not now. As a teenager, I was taught to play the cello, and I did that.
Oh.
I'm happy to talk about Dvorak and Brahms and why Mozart hated cellos and all that stuff.
Oh, excellent.
This is great.
Wow, we're off to a great start.
Yeah, I'm really curious about all the rest of these, too. The next question we have for you is, what's your favorite movie genre?
Good question. I'd say right now, horror.
Oh, that goes along with your musical preference.
I know.
It does. And the weirdest thing was I spent about 5 years working on copyright policy. And, you know, horror, copyright, it really goes pretty closely together.
Oh, yes.
I hesitate to even ask you this next question.
I know.
When you're reading, what kind of things are you reading about?
Right now or in general?
In general.
Really a wide mix. I read a lot of history. I read a lot of literature. I read a lot on technology. I'm starting a book right now to write, not to read, on climate change in higher education. So I'm reading a lot on climate change. I used to read a lot of philosophy and theory, and I still read some of that. And then, you know, occasionally books on technology, although I rarely find any that get my interest.
Okay, very good. Wow.
Do you have a favorite international travel destination?
Well, I love going to Malta. It's just a great, tiny country, wonderful people. And I also love Australia because Australians are just fantastic people.
Hmm. Very good. Okay, so this has by far been the most interesting collection of answers that we've ever had to this segment of the show.
Oh, excellent. Which I guess we're done. Right.
Yeah, and now it's hard to move on to the serious stuff.
Oh, this is going to top all the rest of them. So, you describe yourself as a futurist, and other people describe you that way as well. What has been your journey to kind of get to where you are today?
That's a great question. I'm a Generation X person, so I usually don't like talking about myself, so I'll make this as brief and painless as possible. my graduate work in the 1990s was in English literature. I did my PhD on doppelgangers, and that, in, at the same time, did a lot of work in teaching with technology, and also scholarship of technology in education. And that helped get me my first teaching job at Centenary College in Louisiana. And I did a lot of work there and a whole bunch of things, but I did a lot of work on how education and technology intertwine. Everything from I did work on virtual worlds, gaming, how you communicate online, to how to form communities online, how to teach online. And this led me to my next big gig. I worked for about 10 years with the National Institute for Technology and Liberal Education, which is a nonprofit that worked with about 200 to 300 small colleges around the U.S. And I was their kind of leader for emerging technology, among other things. And I spent a lot of time talking to presidents, provosts, deans, faculty, librarians about emerging technologies. So, you know, this is circa 2002 to 2012. And I, you know, telling them about crazy new stuff like mobile devices or social media. And one of the things I found was that if I went to a campus, just dropped me on a campus, I could talk to about half the people pretty easily. The problem was, if I used the technology word, I would lose about the other half of the people. And I investigated this, and one of the reasons I would lose people was because they didn't like technology. They were just flat out anti-technology, which usually meant they were anti-digital technology, or they were opposed to a part of digital technology. But then others were just, they didn't think they had time to worry about it. You know, they were a biologist or a French scholar, and that was their focus. And it was just something that wasn't worth thinking about, much like a lot of people drive cars without looking under the hood. So I was worried about this. I thought this is a limitation. And then as I was researching more about the implications of technology and education, I realized that we needed to really reframe things in a much broader context. And I found that the futures school of thought, or the several schools of thought under the header of futures, was really a great way. So I could go back to a campus and say, let's talk about the future of education. And everybody would be involved. You know, the professors who say, I'm a Luddite, and the dean who says, I hate spending money in IT. They'd all be fascinated by the future of education. And that let them talk about technology in a much better way. I threw myself into that. And for the past 10 years, I mean, I've been active in the futures world, presenting, consulting, but also I'm on the board of the Association of Professional Futurists, and I've done a lot of work for them and that kind of thing. So I've just never looked back. I mean, for me, the futures path is just the royal road to being able to think about education.
Interesting. I am going to turn the clock back here a little bit. Think back to your first engagement with technology. Do you remember what that was?
You mean digital technology?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was in fifth or sixth grade, and so elementary school, and in New York. And I was brought to look at some different computers. So first, these were mainframes, and then some early PCs, like the VIC-20. And I was fascinated by these. And then in sixth grade, I taught myself the basic programming language. Seventh grade, wrote a couple of computer programs for money for elementary school teachers. And so my first experience in the digital world was things like dot matrix printers, basic command line language, looking into Fortran and COBOL. And really early people, this is before the Apple took off, and this is before, Windows, before DOS rather. That's my first experience. So that was right after punch cards. I never experienced those, but I did spend a lot of time in the local Radio Shack about a mile from my house. And I would just go in there and teach myself how to program and use stuff on the TRS-80 until they kicked me out.
Really? Trash 80, that does go back a ways.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
Excellent.
We saw on your website, it said a quote, "Many call themselves futurists, but Brian actually knows how to do it." I think it came from Academia Next, the quote. What does it mean to be a futurist to you? And how can you be a person who actually does it and be labeled that?
Well, the quote is actually from my good friend, Howard Rheingold.
Okay.
Long-term writer who worked on technology and technology and education. Just a fantastic, fantastic person. Deep thinker, way, way in advance of his time. For me, being a futurist means helping people think better about the future. I don't mean having better vibes or more optimistic point of view, but to give people a clearer sense of their options and of the possibilities as well as what's likely to occur. So to do this, I do a wide range of stuff every day. 365 days of the year, I'm researching. So I'm looking for signals from the present that might point towards the future. And I look at those signals from a wide range of sources, everything from social media to pop culture to print journals. And then I strain those out. I circulate some of them through social media, asking for feedback and what people think. Then I republish them in different ways, including through my blog, including through my monthly Future Trends in Technology and Education report. And they work into other parts of my work, from presentations to workshops to articles and books. Second thing is I build on these. I fuse them into trends. So if we have a whole string of stories, a whole string of data about a certain technology, I try to wrap that into a bundle and see where it's pointing us. And some of these bundles are already pre-given. You think about, say, the Internet of Things, or 3D printing. Mm-hmm. And some of them are a little bit more emergent. I mean, you think about the rise of open educational resources, the rise of open access and scholarly publication. And I track these month after month, year after year, to get a sense of their heft, their power, and their capacity for change. So that can lead to, if you take those trends, you can build other things out of them, including scenarios. And a scenario is just a story about the future, one possible future, usually driven by one or two forces really taking a hand. So it might be, what does the future of education look like if, let's just say, extended reality goes mainstream? Or what happens if healthcare becomes leading sector of the American society and economics? So I publish these scenarios in different ways. I workshop them with different audiences. And these are all ways of connecting with people to try to give them better intelligence about where the future of education is heading.
So do you find when you have these conversations that there are disagreements about what the future might hold or different perspectives on that topic?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's just, that's as it should be. The subtitle of my most recent book is The Futures of Higher Education. Mm. It's a kind of axiom in future studies that we focus on plural futures, multiple possibilities. When you give someone a scenario, it's typical to usually give them several, say three or four, each pointing to different things, depending on what we do now. So it may be that we have, I was just looking at one from Deloitte, for example. They did a recent report where they were looking at the future of higher education, and they looked at it in terms of internationalization and the quality of online learning. And so there are different outcomes that could result depending on, are we more international or less international? Does technology and education become higher quality or lower quality? So thinking about the different, it's a matrix that results. And thinking about the different possibilities gives us insight into what we can do now. Everything from our pedagogy to what we can spend on to how to collaborate.
So how would you assess higher ed's inclination or capability to actually change moving toward the future?
Well, if you're thinking about American higher education, I mean, a key feature of this that's pretty unusual on the world stage is that we are as far from a monolith as you can possibly get. I like to say we are very disintegrated. You know, you think about American higher ed, we've never had a national university, for example, which is unusual. A lot of countries have and do. We have about a third of higher ed is private. So all those colleges and universities are autonomous and independent, can do what they want. The roughly two-thirds that are public are loosely organized at best. You know, you think about city systems like CUNY or state systems like California State. And usually the individual campuses have a lot of practical autonomy. And within them, we have a lot of faculty traditions, depending on your institution, a faculty autonomy. And we also have the sheer complexity of trying to manage all this stuff. So, I mean, to answer your question is we have extraordinary institutional diversity in the U.S. And so, given that background, we do have all kinds of examples of innovation happening across the U.S., but they often either don't scale or they stay within an institution because we have a hard time sharing between institutions. So you know, something may pop up at Beloit or at Harvard or a CSU, one CSU campus, and it stays there because no one else hears about it. And some of them can repeat each other. You can have the same innovation pop up and flourish across the U.S. But we also have all kinds of incentives to not change. We have financial constraints, which have been really taken off since 2008. And of course, right now, given COVID and the recession, are very, very deep. We also have institutional cultures that are very conservative. I don't mean that in the political sense. I just mean institutionally. They are there to conserve. They are there to protect, to maintain. And a lot of faculty get into their positions because of it. I heard a joke. People go into teaching elementary school because they love their students. People go into high school to teach because they love their subjects. People go into teaching higher education because they love themselves. And I don't think that's I don't think that's actually true, the last part, as much. I think a lot of people do think of themselves as representatives of their field or their institution. So, you know, first and foremost, I'm a biologist, or first and foremost, I'm a faculty member at Denison or wherever.
Yeah.
And as such, there's a strong conserving principle there. You know, you're at a small college or a big university and you want to protect it. You think it's great, or you spent your life working in high energy particle physics and you think that's fantastic. You want to advance the fields, but you also want to protect them. So I think that's there. And on top of this, we really do have, we've been lurching from crisis to crisis. You know, 2008, the huge financial crash that we really don't want to talk about anymore. You know, think about 2012, 2013, when total enrollment in American higher education started going down. 2016, when international enrollment stopped rising and started going down. Of course, now the combination of pandemic and recession. And given that, that tends to elicit a kind of hunkering down in a lot of people. They want to hold on, weather this, get through it, come out the other side, and then do something. I think all of those are in many ways disincentives
for change. I first want to thank you for that joke, and I will repeat it numerous times.
You're welcome.
And if people laugh, I will take full credit for it. If they are offended, I will have them email you. So
I'm ready for it.
Oh my.
This has been such a rich and rewarding time that we've spent with Brian Alexander, and it doesn't end now. Brian's going to be back with us next week for part two on Digital to Learn.
Thank you for joining us on Digital to Learn.
If you enjoyed this podcast, there are three things we ask you to do. One, come back and join us again. Two, tell your friends about us. And three, give us a positive ranking on your favorite podcast platform.
Digital to Learn is brought to you by the Center for Learning and Innovation at Indiana Wesleyan University.
It's a digital world.
Always keep learning.